Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So Saturday night at the monastery, and you can see if you do this kind of pattern every day, what a powerful effect it could have on the mind, where you set up a formal situation, have formal iconography, have an etiquette of kind of communal chanting, reflecting, seeing a Buddha image, remembering the precepts, reflecting on kind of ethical standards, reflecting, say, an 8 precepts on renunciant standards. Do that every week, or the meditation every day. You can see how that would have a profound effect on the mind. It might not be obvious in the beginning, but you imagine doing it, like coming together, doing this every day, every day. And that's monastic life. It's like, this is our evening meal. we don't go out for fish and chips. We take refuge in the Buddha. And one could go through this and just do it like sort of parrot, just go through the motions. I don't think this is also novel, I think, for most of you, that you haven't got to the parrot stage yet. But there was that danger of just sort of going through the motions just another day. But it is an incredible opportunity, isn't it? Just to sit quietly, to remember the Dhamma, to be reminded of goodness. This is skill, and the Buddha's teaching is very pragmatic, in the sense that it says to us that we have a possibility as human beings to be profoundly happy, say, profoundly open-hearted, profoundly at ease, serene. These are possibilities of the human human being, and that also we have the ability to see ourselves in time. I think Peter Singer, the guy that wrote the animal rights books, I think he wrote that an ethical being is one who can see themselves in time. You think about it, if I cannot see the consequences of my actions, it's hard for me to be moral. It's only when I can see the consequences of my actions that I can contemplate what morality is and what ethics are, because I see when I do this, I get that. When I do this other thing, I get this other thing. So the Buddha taught or indicated to us that we can see ourselves in time, we can see the consequences of our thoughts, our speech and our actions, we can see what kinds of actions lead to happiness and what kind of actions lead to suffering. And we can do skillful things, we can do unskillful things, and we can watch the effect of doing skillful things and doing unskillful things. So we can observe a kind of feedback mechanism in our own life according to what we do. And that's really what the training is about, it's what the law of karma is about, it's what ethics is about, it's what liberation is about, it's that simple simple yet profound activity of human awakeness and human responsibility, watching, witnessing, so that if you think about that just in terms of skill, if I can come together with a group of people or on my own, and I can recollect the wholesome, right? So I can recollect the Buddha, I can recollect the fact that there is enlightenment, that there is a path, the Dhamma, and there are beings who are doing this. I can recollect the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. I can do that, then that's skill. That's something I do which is skillful. Maybe not, doing this chanting, like, big deal, right? No big deal. But if I do that for 20 years, each time I do that, if I can do it mindfully, and I really recollect Buddha Dhamma Sangha, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and I recollect what that means in my life, or get a sense of that in an intuitive way or even a devotional way, then imagine, do that over 20 years, what a powerful effect that has on consciousness at a level which might which is deeper than just an idea about Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So that's skillful, because it's a skillful thing to do. Or that I sit down and I just try to meditate, and just to try to watch the breath or do some metta practice. I may not be successful, I may not think I am successful. But if I do it for 20 years, every day I just try, and I look and I observe and see how does this work, how does this not work. That's going to have a powerful effect. So I suggest to go for this, go for it and be it in for the long haul. Don't worry about, about the results tomorrow. But stay in it for the long haul, and just continually cultivate the skillful, and abandon the unskillful. And that's the path, really. That's how the path is talked about. Someone put down 7 pieces of tape under this carpet which Jane is sitting on now. We're not going to lift the carpet. So the tape was to prevent people from slipping on the waxy floor, right? And of course the test was, why are there 7? They tested the Ajahn, these two. Why are there 7 pieces of tape? And I guessed right, it was the 7 factors of enlightenment. So guess what? You get these lists in Buddhism, right? You get these lovely lists, and the challenge of the kind of list dharma, as it were, is to use it as a way to live your life with a background of dharma. A background of always contemplating the Dhamma, and this is we have the capacity to, like, I have the capacity to speak with you now, right? And then I have a kind of background capacity to notice where I'm coming from. I can function at 2 levels, can I? And that's not multitasking, I suppose, some aspect of it, but not only can I speak, I can notice that I am speaking, right? Not only can I notice that I'm speaking, but I also can notice that I'm speaking from a good place, or a confused place, or an excited place. I can notice that. It's amazing. I think it's quite amazing. And also I can make adjustments. So if I'm getting too frenetic in my speaking, I can kind of say to yourself, slow down, have a glass of water, be cool. Or if I'm receiving a question, this is from a guy that talks a lot on these things, if I'm receiving a question and the person is asking something and I'm getting aggressive in my answer, I can notice that, can I? I can notice myself getting aggressive with the answer, and I can hopefully think, slow down, be cool. So we have this kind of wonderful capacity not only to function, but to notice how we function. Not only to act, but notice how we act. Not only to think, but notice why we're thinking. So the seven factors of enlightenment, I think the first three would be sufficient. But if you did the list, you do sati, dhamma, the investigation of dharma, persistence or energy, piti is gladness, and pasadi is serenity, samadhi is concentration, and upekha is equanimity. So you have like the first three, sati, dhammavijaya, and virya. Let's look at those. Right? The thing about lists is that you can get very kind of hung up on lists and say, well, was that sati? Or was that yoniso manasikara? Or was that sati sampajanya? If you know the Pali, you know. So these words are kind of suggestions to help us to really observe the way things are. So they are on some hand, in some ways, they are things we should observe in consciousness. These are important things to observe in your own conscious experience. Some of them are how to observe. How do you actually observe? What is observation? Right? And you probably find that various ways that these words are defined, and you can have a debate about, well, you know, should you? Is that right or wrong? I think that. The skill is in reflection. Does any teaching or any list help you to be more happy? Right? Just simple. Rather than is this the kind of ultimately correct way to use a word? So how's that for excusing myself if I get it wrong? Sati, you hear that word a lot, I think. The cat in Birkin is called Sati. So, people think about sati as like the awakened mind. Buddhists like to name their animals, their cats, by these Pali words. I like Conrad better myself. So sati, awake. Just going back to the question about the mind reacting to something that say Marion brought up. You see, the first thing you have to do is you have to actually notice that you're reacting, don't you? You have to actually awaken to what is going on. Because although I can sort of partially know I'm reacting to something, I could just be reacting to my reaction. And like you get this sort of sense of, yeah, I'm really upset, but we don't really awaken to being upset, or I'm feeling really uptight. We don't really sometimes really fully, this is how it feels, this kind of full awakening to what's going on. So that's the kind of step that is so obvious, but so often is difficult, because quite often we just react to something in an old way to try to get rid of it, or we distract it or whatever. So you could see that awakening the mind to the way things are is so primary to any kind of understanding, and then sustaining that awakened mind for some kind of a span. So that's what we do in meditation, right? You sit down, you got no distractions except your own mind and your body. And there's nothing to do, you have no responsibilities, nothing complex, and you just try to stay with it for an hour. Right? Now, if your mind feels confused or you feel sleepy and you keep noticing, even though the meditation itself might have felt like a failure, you could judge it that way, but just the fact that you've been here 45 minutes or an hour, and you haven't run away, and you've noticed discomfort, and you've noticed, you know, kind of that you're falling asleep and things like that, you've developed the first part of it, the first factor of awakening, because you've tried to awaken. So if you look at meditation as a success and failure, had a good one, had a bad one, then it's very frustrating, because mostly you get bad ones. you can kind of feel like a failure. But if you felt sleepy for this meditation, right, and you really just tried to say, oh, I'm sleepy, you kept coming back to that, actually that was a good meditation. The energy might have been dull, but you really made, you know, you made some kind of effort to notice sleepiness, right? Or restlessness or whatever. So that is not the awakening to the way things are isn't necessarily that you're having a pleasant experience, but you've made this attempt to awaken the mind. So keep reminding yourself of that, no matter what's going on, no matter how pleasant or unpleasant, or how annoying life is, or your moods are, or how difficult the body is, or the relationships, just keep doing that. Keep awakening to this is the way it is now. Now it's not. Keep doing that. And again, if you make that suggestion to yourself for 20 years, then that's going to be a powerful factor. You're just going to notice things more, aren't you? You're just going to notice things as they arise more, how they affect your body and all the rest of it. Now, within the kind of language around sati, you also have something called sati sampajanya, which is sometimes mindfulness and clear comprehension. You have yoni sammanasikara, which is appropriate attention. You get kind of all kinds of language around that, but you could see that what we have to do is we have to sustain our sense of presence for a span of time so that we can notice cause and effect, right? So that I can notice when I think or act or speak in certain ways, I get certain results. So the second factor of these seven factors, Dhamma Vijaya, is the investigation of Dhamma, or the noticing of the way things are over a span. And within that you have all the teachings. So the basic teaching is suffering, discontent. And going back to the example that we were talking about at tea time, like the mind becoming judgmental, and then me becoming judgmental to the mind, we can quite often just be trying to, you know, get rid of something and sort it out. We never really question, well, what's the cause of suffering? What's the cause here? Well, you know, where is it coming from? And you get that teaching so many millions of times, but actually, to awaken to that question, to make that the question, well, what's really going on now? What's the problem? Why am I suffering now? Why? What's the discontent? Rather than just judging yourself or trying to get rid of what's going on, actually making conscious that there's something amiss now. So, like, let's say if you're meditating and you are feeling sleepy, right, and you're just trying to get rid of sleepiness, you're just trying to get up. You never really awaken. Well, what is sleepiness? And what is the suffering of sleepiness? What's going on now? You never brighten the mind with that question. Then you might repress it, but then you fall back again. And each time sleepiness comes up, you'll never really learn about it. So, in developing meditation, and in developing this, the factor of Dhamma Vijaya, if your meditation isn't working, don't just hate yourself. Inquire, well, what is, you know, why isn't it working? Why isn't my mind peaceful? Why can't I settle the mind? Or why does my head hit, you know, keep kind of falling over? Why? Why? What's going on? Why do I suffer? What is sleepiness? How does it work? How does it come up in the body? What happens to my breath? What happens to my posture? What kind of thoughts are there? How does the brain feel? A million questions for one observation, right? And so, like, in meditation, it's another thing you're learning to do. You're learning to inquire. You're learning to inquire about the effect of your intentions and efforts has on your mind. What's the effect? What's the result? Not in a kind of success and failure way, but actually, well, when I make this kind of effort, does it lead to a peaceful result? When I make this kind of effort, does it gladden my mind? Or do I just fall asleep? So like if you do, if someone leads a breath meditation and you fall asleep, then you need to ponder that. Or if you always fall asleep when you meditate, some people always, you know, they sit, as soon as you sit down, they're off. And they're nodding. So, what do you do there? Well, first of all, you have to awaken to the fact that you're falling asleep. Obviously, right? And that is very difficult because you're falling asleep. And really, I'm not being facetious, like, the hindrances to meditation are very deluding. So some people, meditation just becomes a habit of falling asleep. You know, just kind of get comfy, get yourself in your zone, and then and the mind just goes off into thinking, dull states. So it's not as easy as it sounds. So what you have to do is you have to kind of encourage yourself to actually, like sleepiness is one of the hindrances that quite often people get into after they've been meditating well, because in the beginning usually they feel restless and their knees hurt. So after a while people, sometimes they get so comfortable, you know, they got their nice little bit of technology or they got their nice chair and they just relax too much. Just get, like some people use meditation to fall asleep. You know, if I use breath to fall asleep, what's that going to mean when I meditate? Mm. So all my associations about breath are to fall asleep. Whereas actually, meditation should be making very bright. Very, very bright. So one of the things that in the seven factors of enlightenment, or the seven factors of awakening, is to contemplate the hindrances to meditation. So what do you, in terms of Dhamma Vijaya or contemplation, you're looking at, why can't you make the mind peaceful? What is it? What is it about your, why can't you make the mind bright? The two things we talk about in meditation is calmness and brightness. You get too much calm and you just kind of snore. Too much brightness and you're just too fired up. You've got too much energy. So you know, as you're meditating, you're really investigating energy. It's one of the things of Dhamma Vijaya. You're investigating energy, and what is energy in meditation? What is vitality in meditation? What is too much energy? What is too little effort? What is dullness? What is brightness? How does it work? And only you can figure that out. You can get all the suggestions you want. So in the meditation that we did earlier, I did the kind of long breathing, stretching the spine and all of that. And I've noticed when people are sleepy, I can be talking, I can be saying long breath in, long breath out, and they're doing long snore in, long snore out. Not even there, not even listening. They're just in gaga land, just nodding off because it's so comfortable, right? So dullness is very comfortable. The mind just kind of dulls up. Ajahn Chah used to recommend sitting on the edge of a well. walking backwards. Walking into thorn bushes, all kinds of things. But if you do feel sleepy, realize that that is one-fifth of the hindrances. So if you feel sleepy, then you say, ah, okay, good. Now, I got to figure out how to work with this hindrance. Right? Now, it might be that you're just exhausted. Then the way to work with it is to go to sleep, not here, upstairs, you know, get a bed and just sleep. So sometimes sleepiness is people are just exhausted. So usually in the first days of a retreat, first 3 days, people are just very sleepy, they're falling asleep a lot. So there's that kind of dullness there. Other people, as soon as they're not busy, they're dull. They just go into dullness. The mind just starts to think a lot. Right? Some people don't know how to bring energy up. They don't really know how to use the body. Don't use how to use the spine. Some people don't know how to breathe. You know, they kind of just, you know, a little thing going on up here. They don't know how to get the breath really down into the belly. They don't know how to energize. They don't know how to bring oxygen into the body. They just don't know how to do that. So I've had dullness. I had a little bit of dullness this afternoon, but just working with it, you just know what to do, right? So the third factor of the seven factors is vidya or tanisro, translated as venerable tanisro. Sorry, translated as persistence. Sometimes it's translated as energy, but you see, if dullness is a particular hindrance in my meditation, I've just got to keep at it until I understand it, not to get rid of it, but just so I know, this is a lack of vitality. This is what I do. I go to sleep. No, I've tried to sleep. So I think all of us probably have seen what a power nap does. You know, you can get a power nap for half an hour and get out of dullness. Or you can be on the... I've noticed that if I'm doing a self-retreat, I'll try to sit through dullness of just half an hour. I just can't get out of it. And I'll do a power nap half an hour, and then the rest of the afternoon I'm bright as can be. But other times there'll be dullness. There's just a mind state, a kind of dull mind state. And I'll just have to keep looking, keep using the body. So the body, the spine, the hara, so posture. You know, if you can't get your belly forward and your spine is crumpled like that, the energy is not going to be very conducive for meditation. So like if you, as all of us are getting older, and more of us will be in those chairs with wheels, keep developing a good posture. Don't let the small of your back go like that. Don't let your chest collapse. Just don't, you know what I mean? You just gotta learn to open up your chest. If dullness isn't a problem, well, okay. But if dullness is a problem, you find the caved in chest, the belly contracted, that, forget it. So posture, you can go the other way. You can become military and that, but that won't work either. All of this is just to say that to understand just this one thing, this one hindrance called dullness, you have to know that you're dull. You have to recognize, you have to say to yourself, wow, I have a lot of dullness in my sittings, right? And then you have to investigate, not just intellectually, but the energy of dullness, what it does, what kind of thoughts are there, why I lose the plot, and I have to persist, and I have to figure out ways to energize myself, right? And you could see that would lead to the other factors. The other factors are when you've kind of sorted out one of the hindrances. So piti is gladness. You know, when you can really gladden your mind, you're not dull. Pasadi is serenity. Your mind becomes serene. Samadhi is you have focus for distance, for spans of time. And upekha is your heart doesn't get blown away by wrong emotions. It's balanced. So that's just around one hindrance. But with that one hindrance, you've also developed these three factors. You've developed sati, you've inquired, you've persisted, right? And that's true of all the hindrances. So for another person, it's like restlessness is a huge, huge kind of thing in the human consciousness. The mind always needing to do something. The hindrances of aversion, love and hate that we have, those are strong hindrances. So they come up like the person who can't settle the mind, who likes to be very creative and just goes off all the time, building things, creating things, giving Dhamma talks to the cat, or fixing this or doing that, and the mind just does not know how to settle. The mind is always in thought, always in the future, creating, developing, whatever, or in the past. So that if that, that's the same kind of pattern, really, that you apply sati, Dhamma Vijaya, and Virya. And those are really what you're always working with. You're working with those three all the time. You're always trying to awaken. And then you're trying to sustain your awareness of your inner world. And why? Why do I suffer? Why does my mind go into self-disparagement? Or why does it go into worry? Or why does it become critical? Or why does it always want something more? Why can't it settle into good enough? Why can't it do that? And it's not just a sort of intellectual, it's a kind of watching of yourself, watching of how your mind enters into realms of suffering. So like for me now, my sati, Dhamma, Vijaya and Virya has been around anxiety, around my mother. It's been really good because I can just see this sort of visceral anxiety I have around her well-being, which has a good aspect to it, because, you know, then I'm very careful with her health and her medicine and her diet and her videos. but also it's deeper than just deeper than just filial piety, as it were. It's like I can really watch this profound state of mind now, day in and day out. I can see it coming up. I can see how the perceptions it creates. I can see how it affects my body. I can learn a lot about it. And that's the particular aspect of consciousness which I can investigate now. But it's the same kind of thing, isn't it? Awakening. Oh, this is the way it is now. This is that feeling. Then watching how the papancha or the mental proliferation. No, don't do that. Come back. Applying the antidotes to it, and just persisting with that. When I started to give Dhamma talks, it was the same boring pattern of fear. Just the same thing. What are you going to say? They'll throw me out if I say anything. Will they like me? Will they love me? It wasn't mental. It was guttural. It was in the guts. And every day. Every day, the same kind of anxiety, the same kind of fear, teaching. I don't know, maybe you have that when you teach. And so these kinds of things in life which persist because they're strongly ingrained in consciousness, if you have a chance to see them again and again and again, you can really learn a lot because they have a kind of repeated pattern. But it's the same thing, it's awakening. Sustaining that awake mind and then seeing where the attachment is, and then persisting in letting go. Just really, having a lot of persistence in letting go. And you could see, if I can persist in this way, that which is skillful, that which is like awakening is very skillful. Watching cause and effect and then making efforts which are skillful, which are wholesome, and then abandoning the unwholesome. If I do that for 20 years, then I've developed a lot of skill and I've abandoned a lot of unskillfulness, a lot of unwholesomeness. And then there's the foundation for liberation, because all those factors have been just gently, really, and persistently encouraged in consciousness. I've just encouraged awakeness, awakeness, awakeness. One of my story, classic story of fear. I've told this one on many retreats, so I've only got a few stories. Sorry, Don. But I had been giving talks for quite a few years, and I gave a talk in Auckland, to an interfaith group, and my dad had just died, and I had just returned from Toronto to be at this interfaith gathering, and I was the Buddhist speaker. I wasn't the keynote speaker, and I just had to speak for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and I gave a really good Dhamma talk because it was so close to my father's dying. So it was really right on. It really felt right on. It was very sincere, very good. So they, everyone was impressed. So they said, "Would you be the keynote speaker next year?" I said, "Oh yeah. Come next year, right? We're in this big cathedral in Auckland. See, hundreds of people. I get a panic attack. Not now." And I was really frightened. I was just like petrified. I just could not believe the depth of fear that came up. Oh God, how do I get out of here? I couldn't get out. I was just stuck. And I had to give the keynote address. I was just and I hadn't had the shakes for a few years. The worst time. So it's this kind of upwelling, totally irrational fear. Now, people, you know, if you have something like that, people say, "Well, don't be afraid." You know, you can grab it by the throat. Well, it'll be all right. They all like you. And none of that works. None of it works because this is karma. It's just come in. It's just there. So I gave the talk. And this is a peace meeting. And I gave an aggressive talk. Because, you know, when you have fear, then you override it with aggression or something like that. Anyway, so I give this kind of really be peaceful talk. And then I felt just awful. You know, I kind of walked away from that feeling very awful. And I just kept saying, "No, it's all right, you did it." So I'm driving back to Auckland to the Tibetan monastery where I was staying that day, and Lama Sumten, he's a very compassionate Tibetan monk, and didn't realize the predicament I'm in, and in this kind of very Asian way, kind of roundabout, you know, he says, "You know, Buddhism's about peace, you know." And then, of course, with the mind, want to go into self-disparagement, doesn't it? Yeah. But at some place, you just got to break the self view. I just had to keep breaking it. No, you gave it a go. You did it. You know, you did your best. There was no intention. It's an awful experience. And yet, you know, if I just let go of that self disparagement, I was very peaceful that following week. You know, something got released in me that only that kind of situation maybe, you know, could have triggered. So, the uprising of suffering is quite often not really suffering, it's just unpleasant. Because what was the problem there? The problem wasn't the panic, right? It was me not wanting the panic because I had to speak to a group. And what could I do? I did what I could. You know? So, I mean, that was good practice. Now, Lama Sumten, in his good-hearted way, thought I was just being aggressive, right? Kind of, but I wasn't. You know, it wasn't me, really. It was just the very best one could do. And so it is in life that you can sometimes, it might look like failure to others, but actually, was it really failure? Was it just doing the best that one could do with a kind of that kind of situation? And sometimes the arising of kilesa or defilement is really not rational. You know, it's not. And when it is so irrational, you can really see this is not self. It really isn't me. This is just karma. This is just energy coming through. And if one has a kind of body of practice in place, then when those things happen, you can get through it. You can get through it, and if you've got enough awareness, actually it can be very purifying. A kind of purifying experience. But it's these three you're always working with, right? Awareness, wakefulness, and watching, observing, understanding, investigation. and persistence. You really have to persist in this practice, in this life. You just have to keep at it. So my sense at that moment was, oh, all that practice, and this is what I get? Yeah. But who knows? Who knows the karma of this being? And if it, you know, I can imagine if I have to give a talk to 1,000 people somewhere, maybe it'll happen again. So be it. That's it. So it's not for, I don't think it's just for us to say that the kind of quality of our conscious experience in terms of what gets triggered, right? That sometimes you can't do. Like, the things get triggered between in relationships or with kids or parents. Sometimes they're so powerful. The things that get triggered with one's mother, right? It's just so utterly powerful that you don't know where they come from. So not to, you don't have to judge that, the uprising of things, but what you can work with the way things are. So if I can keep coming back to that compassionate statement, this is the way it is now. It is a compassionate statement, it's not a judging statement. This is the way it is now. Then there's a huge chance for edification and understanding in that. But that's a big step in human consciousness, to actually notice the way things are. Okay, so I'll leave that for your reflection tonight.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.